button. Okay, welcome everybody. Tonight is March 9th, 2024. It is the last of this season. Tonight we changed the clock. Don't forget to change the clock later. It is, tonight is the 16th in our lecture, and it's part two of Shaul Shlomo Paul Hirsch. I don't think I'm going to finish tonight, but we'll get a little bit further. Okay, so we did mention just a little bit of, just to remind us of the background of Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch, he learned from Rav Chacham Isaac Barnes. That was like one of his rebbeim. That was one of his mentors. If you remember, Rav Barnes became the Rav in Hamburg. And Hamburg had, in fact, the first Reform shul. You know, before that, we were talking about Israel Jacobson. They had minyanim in houses, or they were renting different places. But to build a shul, you know, for as a temple, a Reformed temple, that was Hamburg, and that was the that was the first place. And whoever it was from the traditionalist camp is what they used to call them, or the from the Orthodox camp. He had the idea of hiring a polished frum rav, and that was who Isaac Barnes. Everything about it was political, right? Even the name, he was called Chacham. They didn't want to call him rabbi. Some say the shul didn't want to call him a rabbi because they didn't want him, you know, or he himself didn't want to be called a rabbi. So what do you call him? They called Chacham. Was like the Sfardim, and he was basically, what he did is he took the teeth or the push out away from the Reform. He was a polished speaker. He spoke in German. He put on the robes, but everything he said was just Torah true. He was a tremendous Talmud Chacham. And one of his students was, in fact, Reb Hirsch. And that's probably where he got his, you know, his ways of doing things. He saw how Barnes had to deal with the community at large, had to deal with the from people within the community. So he had to deal with the Reform outside the community. And one of the reasons why Hamburg did not, like, just totally go all over the Reform was because of Barnes. He also had to do with Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, where he got his smicha from. And those were like his Rav Hirsch's two rabbis.
What year?
Oh, good question. I think he was early 1800s. Well, if you're working backwards, in 18, he's going to... In 1851, he's going to come to Frankfurt, and he was already 20 years in the rabbinate. So 1830s to probably the 1820s to 1830s. I don't remember the date. So we had the dates on the last one. When he first became a rav at the age of 22, his first shtella, his first city was Oldenburg, which was a very, very small area, poor and small, and that gave him his time to be able to sit and learn. And he was writing most of the day, and that's what he, you know, whatever his responsibilities as a rav was, it still left him a lot of time for his thinking, for his writing. One of his students at the time, I don't think he was, eventually he wasn't proud of him, but was Gratz. He was the Gratz. Yeah. He was the big historian. He wrote a 5-6 volume of history of the Jews. But what happened when again, this is just the background. When Rav Hirsch was in Oldenburg, he wanted to start a chedarim. He wanted to start schools. The only thing is he realized he can't just teach Torah. The Torah is going to be taught like on the highest level, the way it was from Sinai. This was going to be his Torah im Derech Eretz. I don't know if, again, we'll get to it today, but there's a lot of confusion of what does Torah im Derech Eretz mean? You know, and people want to say whatever they want it to mean, and then they build their schools based on, well, Torah and Derech Eretz. But an understanding was it's Torah, but you have to be able to deal with the society around you. And he wanted to build, you know, start schools, but the people in Oldenburg who would be potential teachers, they didn't have the background that Rev Hirsch wanted to teach them, that for them to have. So there were no texts, there were no, you know, books or whatever like this. So he actually created the textbook. He wrote his famous, this is when he wrote his famous Chumash called Chorev. So originally he wanted it to be for like a textbook so the people in Oldenburg could teach the students. But he realized it was great stuff and we can go public with this. And that's what he wanted to do. When he brought it to the publishers said, well, this is great stuff, but there's no market for this. This is, you forget where we are. We're Germany, mid-19th century. Everybody's going reform. This is like, you know. So in order to convince the publishers that there's a market for this, he said, let's make something a little smaller. And that's when he came out with his 19 letters. And basically the 19 letters is letter one is he himself wrote it all. It's like himself, but he wrote it in the name of a boy, a very secular-minded boy by the name of Naftali. And he's writing to his friend, mentor, who's a traditionalist. And the first letter is everything that the Reform, that's what they all hold and they believe. And what's this with this archaic stuff and, you know, too much this and not that. And the next 18 letters is the response to this boy, Naftali. And what it basically goes through the goals and the missions of what Klal Yisrael is and what it is and what the purpose of we are here in this world and what Torah does for us and what Hashem is in all the whole world and how society is. And this is all this is what the 19 letters were. The 19 letters was a big hit. It was a bestseller. Every Frum person had this book. This was the answer finally to the Reform. It was like a quick answer.
Was it an attack on Reform?
It was, yes, it actually was. It was actually an attack on Reform, and it was an attack on the Reform, not on any individual. It was an attack on their ideals and what they think that's it. We're in a new world and everything is all modern and everything is, the Torah is fluid and it changes just like Christianity believes that Christianity is fluid and changes. And he was showing that that's not so. It was a big hit. Every Frum person had this in this house, this book, and the 19 letters. And it was, they had even parts of it committed to memory. When that became a big, you know, the printers saw that this was, there's a market for this. So then his Chorev book was printed as well. But this all happened in Oldenburg. Is it working today? No, it's still not working. It's all. I should have brought my. Okay.
Chorev is Zach's famous book. Chorev is his.
Oh yeah, that's his book on Chumash. And actually, his 19 letters is supposed to be the beginning of, or it was like the. Preface or the introduction, or it's supposed to really fit with Chorev. In other words, he's always alluding to something where is it written and everything. He doesn't say the word Chorev. I don't think he says the word Chorev by name, but he's alluding to something. And then when Chorev came out, he says, "Oh, okay, that's in the 19 letters. This is where all of his ideas in the 19 letters came out from." But that was all in Oldenburg. When Gratz read the 19 letters, he says, I want to be part of this guy. And he actually came to Oldenburg. He spent a few years in Shamshel Raphael Hirsch's house. And that's where he spent some time. Evidently, it wasn't enough. He and Gratz went off, and he became part of with what's his name? With Levinson, he became part of the conservative.
So he became really conservative with an answer to the reform.
Right. So when he came out with that book, it was also very in the conservative style of thing, which also they hold that things evolved. And he, Hirsch, gave an answer. He wrote against the history of the Jews, of Gratz's history of the Jews. But we have like what his schedule in Oldenburg was. Is, I mean, he woke up 4 o'clock in the morning and he started, that's when he was learning and writing. He was writing all his life. He then got a bigger Stellar Emden. And in Emden, there he became very busy. It was a bigger place and they needed more help with his, you know, his organizational talents, and he had to, you know, was constantly working and helping the communities. There was more people, and it was more outlying. He had more responsibilities. And again, also in Oldenburg, he was there for a few years, and Emden also for a few years, I think like 4 or 5 years each, till finally Nicholsburg opened up, and that's what we were speaking about last week. Nicholsburg was probably the biggest, if not the biggest, the top three biggest rabbanus in the entire world. There were over 50,000 Jews that were under his rabbanus, and in over 52 communities. And this is what we spoke about last time. He was on the pinnacle of the world. When he came, he came there in 1847, he came to Nicholsburg, and we mentioned last time in Nicholsburg, he came in 47, in 1848 was the Second French Revolution, Republic, and this created about another 50 revolutions, counter-revolutions in all of Europe. So for the next 2 years, all of Europe was turned upside down, one revolution after another. Everybody wants emancipation, everybody wants more rights. And it started in France and it worked its way into all these German states, including, you were gonna see, including Frankfurt too, where he's gonna end up. Prussia, the king had to deal with it. Prussia and Austria were two of the biggest German confederate states that there were. And Austria, this is where Nicholsburg was in fact in Austria. And it went further than that. It didn't go into Russia because the Tsar of Russia would have none of it, and he didn't allow anything to happen there. But the rest, all over in Italy, all over in Austria, Germany, Prussia, even in the Ottoman Empire, with like two or three cities that had these uprisings. The end of it all, most of it was that after 2 years, the powers that were the emperors and the kings basically, you know, after 2 years, put most of it down. But for 2 years, there was talk and there was, you know, things going on, and people became freer because of it. They realized, I guess, the emperors and the kings realized they have to start giving more freedom. But the end of it is that it didn't turn out as, you know, it didn't all turn out like the United States of America, where everybody's free and there was everything. It was more concessions were made, but things basically went back to the way it was. And now in Nicholsburg, from the 4 years that Shamshel Frol Hirsch was there, he was working towards this idea of emancipation. The Jews should be included as well. You would think, you know, people, emancipation, Jews are people, you know. You would think that, you know, they would apply to the Jews, but certain bad feelings. Don't leave. Don't die. They don't hide.
Everybody loves it.
Is either Horeb or the 19 letters available today?
Yes, it is. Both of them are available.
Oh.
You can buy them. I think, is it Feldheim? I'm not sure. But yeah, you can go to any shul. I'm sure Shari has them. I'm sure Shari has both of them. I would be surprised if they didn't. Could be they don't, but you can go get them at home. Okay, and that's what Hirschfeld became busy with. Because in 1848, things started, you know, with becoming emancipation. We spoke about this mostly last year.
Yeah.
And he was largely successful that eventually that they got the Jews, that the emancipation applied to the Jews as well. And now when that happened, so there was sort of like a backlash. Now, but just before that, we also mentioned that he was very Hirsch, believed and put all his strength into getting emancipation for the Jews. And he wrote extensively. We spoke about it last week. But his main idea was emancipation is not a thing in of itself. In other words, the whole thing of Gullus is not that, okay, now we're free and now we can do whatever we want. We're equal with the Goyim. That's not what the purpose of emancipation for the Jew is. The emancipation for the Jew is now that we're free and we're not bound or discriminated against and shackled by the Goyim, now that we have emancipation, we have more opportunities and we could serve Hashem on a higher level. That's what the attitude should be for the Jews. And he was working very hard for that. The only thing is, and now we're going to come to where we're heading towards tonight, is that along with emancipation came emancipation from having to be part of the Jewish community. Now, the way it worked in many countries in Germany and in Europe, especially Germany and many German states, was that you had to be part of a community. And if you were not part of the community, if you were a Jew, you had to be part of the community. And if you were not part of the community, you had to be Christian. Wow. There was no such thing as you're a Jew and not part of the community. And that's why it was when the Reform was able to take over, if they were able to take over the community, they had that's it. You can't break off from us because then you're Christian. Now you have to follow us, and we're telling you this is what it is. On the other hand, it worked in a certain way for the religious. If the religious are in charge, that means everything, you know, everybody has to go to yeshiva, and everybody, there's the shuls, and there's the mikvahs, and there's Torah and mitzvahs, and that's what you have to do as well. You are part of the from community. The only thing is as we all know, you can't force people, you know, you could force people to do certain things, to go to shul and to do mitzvahs and learn Torah, but if they're being forced, how much is it really worth, right? At some point, the moment they're no longer forced, is they're not going to be so strong about it. That's unfortunately, you see, you know, as kids get older, if they're in yeshivas and they feel like they're being forced to do whatever they're doing, once they get older and they feel they're more independent, so they, you know, unfortunately, if they're not, they don't appreciate what they have, they may go on a journey, you know, let's put it like that. So one of the things he found out, Hirsch found out, realizing now is once in Austria, they received a certain amount of emancipation, autonomy, so no longer did the Jews have to pay taxes to the Jewish community. And now the Jews felt like, you know, we don't have to, why should we have to pay?
Well,
so,
why did emancipation mean they no longer had to pay to the...
Right, before emancipation, you had to pay taxes to the to the Jewish community, however it was
well,
structured.
How did that change through emancipation?
Well, they no longer had to be part of the community.
They could go outside
the community and still be a Jew. So you didn't have to, so what it was is, let's say in Moravia, where you had 50,000 Jews and you had 52 communities, maybe there was a community or two that didn't have a yeshiva, you know, or maybe a few communities didn't have a yeshiva, but other communities had yeshivas. So the community, however the structure was, they taxed all the Jews, and they took the Jews, even though you're living in an area where you don't have a yeshiva, or you don't have kids that are going to yeshivas, but we took your tax money and we helped use it for yeshivas all over, or whatever else was necessary, whether it was butcher shops and mikvahs and shuls and everything.
But the community was responsible.
Right, so it wasn't just small little communities in Germany, it was the larger community that had control of everything. So when they got this autonomy, somehow the taxes were no longer, at least from the government of Austria, they didn't have to pay for these taxes anymore. So now what Rav Hirsch wanted to do is internally now, we have to now go ahead internally from all of us Jews, and we have to force everybody to pay, you know, from within, right? Because now the government is not, you know, well, before it sounded like, my understanding is you'd be able to go to the government and say, listen, this person is not paying his dues to the Jewish community.
But what did they care?
They cared because they're into order and they want people. They would care, then they'd say, listen, you have to be a Christian. Then maybe that's, you know, so you're not paying for there, then you have to be a Christian. So therefore, the Jewish community had that over that person. But now that wasn't the case, they weren't forced from outside to pay taxes. And now Rav Hirsch was trying to get all of the leaders from all the communities to establish some sort of a tax system within, you know, however the Jewish community from within can force everybody to pay to keep the money coming for all its institutions. And Rav Hirsch was having a hard time with this. he was having a hard time getting all the Rabbanim agreeing that they should force all the Jews of Moravia to pay for all the taxes. That was one thing he was having a hard time with. The second thing he was having a hard time with was he wanted control of the yeshivas. And I guess that's the way Rav Hirsch was. He had a certain vision. He had a certain way of doing things. He wanted control of all the educational institutions. He wanted to be the final say on everything. And you can imagine, people have their ways of doing things. This is the way we did it for hundreds of years before you came, and you're not the first rabbi here, and they were giving him a hard time.
Could they keep the Haskalah movement out?
Okay, so that's all part of what Rev Hirsch wanted to do. He wanted to, he wanted to make knowing the winds of change are in the air and knowing what's going on in the world around him, the forces that are coming from the outside, maybe he felt he wanted to make a few changes in the yeshiva. Again, not that he wanted to say, well, you know, in every Gemara lesson we're gonna throw in something, you know, the outside. No, Gemara is Gemara, but what we may have to do as well is something else to help fight off all of these outside influences. And he was getting a hard time with that. Another thing he wanted to do is he wanted to create a yeshiva to train rabbis in the modern era. He was there. He saw it. He understood that these rabbis that have no shaychus with the modern world, with what the average secular Jew knows and what's important to them, and all that you know is all they think you know is just Gemara. Of course, Gemara trains the mind and, you know, you could dole them, they know what's going on around them. But if you can train them in the in their type of logic, and you give them a little bit of a background of certain literature or certain mathematics or history, a chemistry, science, and they have this background, so then you're able to relate to them, and you know how to answer their questions, and you can be a fighting force against what's going on. Now, the more you went east, the less of a problem it was. It came from France and Germany now. Germany reform are sweeping the boards, and we're going to see what's going to happen in Germany. And now it's, even though Austria at the time, most of the Jews there were still from, but the reform was picking up adherents all over. So he knew he was trying to like prepare. He knows what's going on around, and he wants to pick up the battle, and he wants to keep the community strong. And they refused. They weren't even interested in his making such a seminary, yeshiva, to train rabbis to be rabbanim in the modern sense. Again, not that Masorah was Masorah, and everything the Torah is it was everything pure and true, not to chas v'shalom change anything within the Torah, but to help with additional knowledge, or to how to deal with the outside world. And they weren't giving it. He was finding tremendous resistance and frustration. And then all of a sudden he gets a letter. And now that's going to change the world. This letter is going to change the world. But before, the letter is going to come from Frankfurt. And we're going to see now, I want to switch a little bit to go to Frankfurt, and just to see let's do a little bit of a history of Frankfurt. Frankfurt, throughout the years, I mean, we're talking hundreds of years, was always a very, very chashuv Jewish community. I just put over here on the board, in 1606, Reb Shaya Hurwitz, he was the Shalah, he was the Rav of Frankfurt. In Maram Shif, you check him in the back of the Gemara, he's a big Talmud Chacham, like you can't imagine, in the first half of the 17th century, the 1600s. There's a Tiferes Shmuel in 1667. 1741, the famous Pnei Yeshua. I mean, if anybody's in yeshiva, you all know that, Pnei Yeshua, he's the defender of Rashi, when you go through Pnei Yeshua with the sugya, and Tosfos has a whole bunch of questions. It's an amazing what he does. It's deep, it's you need to really have a clear head, but his job usually is for Rashi. 1771, Reb Pinchas HaLevi Hurwitz, the Hafla, the Hamakna, also very common Sfarim, Hafla and Hamakna is on Kedushin and the Dharam. And there was in 1771, he was the Rav there. In 1771, also at the same time, you had the Reb Nassan Adler. Reb Nassan Adler was more of a Kabbalist, but he also lived there. He also, the reason why I put him in there, because he actually was the Rebbe of the Chassam Sofer. He was there, and it was an incident where Reb Nassan Adler, they actually chased him out of town, and they told him he had to leave, and Chassam Sofer left with him. He became his Rav, okay, eventually Chassam Sofer went back, but another one of Reb Nassan Adler's Talmidim was Reb Bing. Reb Bing happened to have been the Talmud of Reb Barnes, who is the Rebbe of Reb Shlomo Sofer Alvarsh. So I mean, it was a town constantly of Torah, of and even so was he just this, even after, up until even through the 50 years or so, the community was under the Rabbanim that were, I guess, from traditionalists, what they would call them, Orthodox, from Gedolim. So Frankfurt, and just more on the modern history, in 1796, this was during the French Revolution, there was a war between France and the rest of the world, and French bombarded the city of Frankfurt. Frankfurt, I believe, even then was like a free city. It wasn't, even though I don't exactly know how government it worked, but It was a city, it was a free city, it had its own constitution, it had its own laws, bylaws, but and it also had a ghetto for the Jews. The Jews had a ghetto, but in 1796, the French bombardment of the city, the Jewish ghetto decimated. The Jews were given permission to live outside the ghetto. The ghetto was never rebuilt, and the Jews were no longer centralized. So again, having centralized Jews, I think overall for the Frum, it's much better because they're all there, and they don't have to Shabbos, you know, everybody sees what you're doing on Shabbos, and you're within walking distance of the shul, it's easy to get to the shul, and all the kosher stuff, it's probably better off for a frum to be more centralized. I mean, we do it ourselves, you know.
War between Napoleon and...
Yeah, so 1796 was before Napoleon. Napoleon was a general then. I think in 1796 he was on the Italian front. 1798 he was in Egypt. 1801 he became emperor. He went back in 1800. By 1801 he took over.
Artillery.
He was a genius on this. I don't think this does in the 1796 bombardment. I don't know if that was Napoleon himself. I don't know. I don't know which battles he was. But yes, this is all. We spent a lot of time on this. This is building up to. But yeah, I'm not exactly sure if Frankfurt was being attacked by Napoleon himself. I don't think so. And if it was, he was only a general then. He wasn't, but I believe in 1796 he wasn't there. He was on the Italian front. Okay. 1805, a free secular school opened up. It was called the Philanthropin. That was the name of the school. It was opened up. It was a free school. It was a secular school. In 1906, Napoleon he dismantled the entire Holy Roman Empire with all the way the Germans, who Germany was for the past 1,000 years, and he basically restructured it to some confederation of German states. There were two of the states, where the biggest ones were Prussia and Austria, but I don't think it was as many as 300-400 states the way it was before, but there was still a number of states, and it was pretty similar. But so one of the things when Napoleon conquered, so one of the different things he did, it was an area called Westphalia, which he made into a kingdom and gave to his brother Jerome. But Frankfurt wasn't part, I don't believe it was part of Westphalia. It was his own free state. And when it was there, he gave that over to a prince, Karl von Dalberg. And that was, he was the regent of it. And it seems that this von Dalberg is very sympathetic to the reformers. And basically, he made a consistory. And again, what were the consistories? The consistories were the government control of the religion. So in France, the government made a consistory for the church. He also made a consistory for the Jews. So the Jews had to answer to the government. That's the way it was set up in France. That's the way it was set up in I guess in Westphalia, and we this is where we saw Israel Jacobson, and he got into the consistory, and he was made all these reform changes, and he forced all of the Jews there to follow his lead. And in Frankfurt, something very similar happened. Frankfurt again was its own city state, and. The governing board in 1808, that's it. It was now reform-minded Jews, and they were now in charge of the Jews. They made some consistory, and now that was the government control of the Jews in Frankfurt. Well, they also did it in such a way that if you needed new members, they could pick new members without having to have elections. So it seems that there was going to be never a way to actually yeah, that's it. They were in forever because you always, you know, your friends. It's almost like the Supreme Court in Israel, you know, like today. You know, that's what the big deal was before with the changes and everything, because you couldn't get rid of them, and they were just, you know, self, you know, helping, you know, just picking themselves who would be the next one. So now even Napoleon's going to fall, and by 1815 there's going to be no more Napoleon, and Europe is just going to just undo everything he did. But in Frankfurt, this board, these reformers still had a lot of control to such a point. Even though the rabbinate, the rabbanim, and the people there were just they were in charge, you know, shul was run, you know, kedasa kedin, and there were yeshivas there. But since they used their power, they were able to do a lot of things. In 1818, again, there's no longer Napoleon. This is post-Napoleon now. In 1818-38, that council, I guess, survived Napoleon, or survived the French, and it was illegal to have any other school other than the philanthropic. The only one school allowed in the entire city, and it was a secular school. It was a reformed school. Shivas were closed.
And this was in what country?
This is Frankfurt, the city of Frankfurt. Again, the city of the way it was back then, again, I don't fully understand, but it seems that it was a city-state in of itself, Frankfurt, and they were independent of anything else, and within the city, the government recognized a council of Jews, which were all reform, and the council of Jews decided, they made a rule, all schools closed except for the philanthropic, which forced every yeshiva, every boy and girl to go to this reform school. So that's one thing. Did I just skip anything?
Yeah.
No. Okay. I got. I think I still. Okay. So. Yeah, I just made it. They also at some point made anybody teaching Torah was subject to a fine.
Mm.
You know, like 50 florin. Just crazy things that they were in charge. They didn't see themselves as just, okay, we're reformed, you're Orthodox, we do our thing, you do your thing.
Were they descended from the Frankists? Where did they get their start?
Okay, so that's a little bit what we were talking. It started, you know, from being secular. It started a little bit from Moses Mendelssohn and his group, and the being part of a society around them, in a society that was cultured, and the Jews wanted to be more cultured and less religious. This is already, we're already into these reform-minded Jews who were already taken away from Torah, and they had their ideas. They wanted to, you know, this is the way. So, and the reformers, they didn't, so it wasn't just, okay, you be yours and we be, you know. They, reformers, felt that we want everybody to be reformed.
Mm.
And that's what they were doing. Get all the kids to our schools, don't allow Torah to be taught. Here's two other things. 200 Jews asked the government of Frankfurt to rebuild two dilapidated churches in 1837. At their own expense, they were denied. They were denied by the government. Again, the government seemed, and the reform-minded Jews were they were tight. They had a good relationship with each other. Permission to renovate old mikvahs were refused. There was no mikvahs in Frankfurt. If a woman wanted to go to the mikvah, she had to go to a neighboring town. She had to go to Bachenheim or Offenbach. Eventually, the council just took the mikvahs and just sealed them up. They didn't just lock the door, and they sealed it up. Anybody who put on tefillin was ineligible to serve on the council.
Wow.
Okay, it was illegal to study Torah in groups. You know, I guess, you know, the communists could have learned from these reformers.
Right.
You know, that's like you see. In 1840s, there were only two locations in the entire Frankfurt that had daily minyanim. Reforms only davened on Shabbos. prayed or whatever, they got together on Shabbos. But and even those two locations weren't always successful in getting minyan. So it's not like you had each one had 500, you know, people each. It sounded like they had just, you know, a minyan, maybe a little more, and sometimes they couldn't get it. In 1842, 2,800 of the 3,000 Jewish families were reformed. There were 200. This compares to half in Bohemia and in Hamburg, where, again, Hamburg, about a third or about a half a third in Hamburg. Again, Hamburg had that first shul, right? That was the first Reformed temple. But yet it wasn't as bad there because probably due to the influence of, let's say, Reb Barnes, where you took the teeth out of their force by having somebody that they could relate to.
Why the question? So why did the Jews stay there? They should have moved to Israel, moved someplace. Why did the Jews stay there?
Well, I guess they all became reformed, you know, everybody becoming modern, and slowly but surely, you know, maybe it probably was. It could be if we had very firm people, they did leave. But, you know, the people grew up, and slowly but surely they went to, the kids grew up, and they, well, what did they know? They didn't know anything about religion, or this is what they were taught religion is, and that's it. They were happy. Wow. The goyim around them, it was all good. So, okay, this is the devil, okay, and this is what the story was, and not only that, but even according the members, most of the members, if not all the members of the Jewish Council, also belonged to the Freemasons. It was a Freemason society, a chapter in Frankfurt, and the council belonged to the Freemasons. So they were like, I guess, probably religiously neutral. It wasn't like they viewed themselves as a sister religion to the Christians. You know, they have what they, and we do a little bit of us. In 1843, and now already things are going to really go south, okay? So up until now, I mean, things are already going south. There's no Torah being learned. Everything is secular. But in 1843, Dr. Leopold Stein, he was in Moscow. He was appointed as the assistant chief rabbi under Rev Trier. Rev Trier was 87 years old at the time. Rev Trier actually was one of the two... if I'm not mistaken, yeah, he was one of the two people sent from Frankfurt to be part of Napoleon's Sanhedrin. Right? Napoleon had to send Sanhedrin. First he had the notables, and then he made a Sanhedrin. So Rev Trier, actually, I believe he was one of the two from Frankfurt that was sent to be he was part of the Sanhedrin of Napoleon. I don't know if it doesn't mean anything.
Oh, yeah. Sanhedrin for the Jewish community.
So another chapter where that was we covered that as well. So Rev Trier was a firm person, and in 87 he realizes they have this now. Leopold Stein is the assistant rabbi, and I guess at 87 it really was too much for him. He resigned, and he said he was so upset with the council for doing this that he wouldn't even take a pension. He had nothing wanted to do with them, and that's it, he resigned. So what happens now? Well, Dr. Stein is now the new rabbi of the shul of the community, and the first thing he does is he makes the shul, he puts in the reforms in the shul, like similar to the reforms of what was doing in Hamburg. Okay, this is, and now we're in 1843. Okay. And now fast forward 6 years. 6 years later, 11 members, 11 people from the Frankfurt community, petitioned the Senate of Frankfurt, and they went to the Senate. This is not the council; they went to the Senate, which is the government of Frankfurt, and they said, "We want to succeed. We want to secede from the Jewish community. Can we?" And they said, look, according to our bylaws and everything, you can't secede. But what they actually allowed them to do is they said you could form your own organization within the community. Okay? In other words, you're allowed to have your own organization, and that organization could be independent from the influence of the reform, but you still got to pay taxes to the community. That they allowed them to do. Ooh, once they allowed them to do, they took it up on them. Now, one of the people, believe it or not, who were one of these 11 people was Ansel Rothschild, one of the richest people in Europe, was one of these 11. If he wasn't one of these 11, within a short time, they had 80 members part of this community. So within a short time, I think within a few months, maybe within a year, they went from 11 members to 80 members. And they call themselves the Jewish Religious Society. Okay, so that's the Jewish Religious Society now. By the next year, 1850, they're up to 100 members. Now, they wanted now, could they have their own rabbi? So of course, the council would say, absolutely not, you're only an organization. But the Senate, believe it or not, gave them the ability to have their own rabbi. So now they had to find a rabbi. They have to realize, even these 80 members, they were very acculturated. They all went to university, they all appreciated the modern culture society, they all dressed modern, their thought was modern. They were just Orthodox, you know, they were from, they didn't want to be reformed. So they had to find, they were looking for a rabbi that they could relate to. Okay, so who did they get? The first person they got was a person by the name, in 1850 was Rabbi Michael Zatz. Now, I don't know too much about him, except that he was, I guess, from, but he did have connections with, as I was referring to before, is Rav Zachariah Frankel. And Frankel, he's going to be the father of the conservative movement. That's where Graetz was teaching in the conservative school that he started. However, after a few months, he left.
Why?
I think his wife didn't feel comfortable. I think that's one of the reasons that they gave. She didn't like Frankfurt. They left after a few months. At least that's the one reason that I saw given.
Well, why wasn't she comfortable?
Women, I don't know. Sorry. I'm asking the wrong person, I have no idea. But in any case, that was the story. Now they were back again looking for a rabbi. Why? Because Hashem didn't want him there. Hashem wanted while they were doing all this, there was a person by the name of Gershon Yosapha. And this Gershon was part of a kollel in Halberstadt, which was near Frankfurt. And while they were trying to figure out who should they get, so Rav Gershon Yosapha happened to have been in the yeshiva at the same time as Rav Shamshel Raphael Hirsch. You see how Hashem just places the right people, these people just at the right time. And he said, you know what? I think Rav Hirsch would be a great person for you. Now, mind you, you know what's going on now in Frankfurt. There's absolutely nothing going on. Everything is against you. You have 100 families that have to do everything and going to the reform. There's no mikveh anymore. The shul, the main shul is, you know, you learn Torah in public, you get fined. This is what it is. The reform took over everything. There's nothing left except the small little organization that was left. So what happened is Rav Gershon Yosapat, he sent a letter, his own letter, to Rav Shamshel Raphael Hirsch. Now, I mean, think of it, the audacity of it. Rav Shamshel Raphael Hirsch is a rub of 50,000 yidden, and the 50,000 Jews, their yeshiva is there, and it's like the biggest rabbanus in all of Europe, the most prestigious. Anyway, this is what he wrote. ... It is true that you presently hold the most important rabbinic post and stand at the pinnacle of the world. Nonetheless, because you are a native of Germany, my acquaintance with you leads me to think that this post would be more suited and more agreeable to you than your present one. The people here are upright and peace-loving, and I can assure you that they will respect you greatly and More importantly, that you will be able to accomplish here a great deal. The material and means exist here in ample measure, and one of the richest people in all of Europe, Ansel Rothschild, was part of these 11. And all that is required is someone who can combine them together. My beloved Samson, you are that someone. This was a letter that Rav Gershon Yehoshaphat sent.
Tomorrow is Adar too.
Oh, look at that, Adar Beis. The second of Adar, okay. So this letter is 1811, we are 20, okay, about 150 years ago. Okay, so here he is, he's getting this letter, and just as he's having tremendously, he's getting frustrated with the community, they're not helping him with restructuring the community under emancipation, they're not allowing him to take help with the take control or the educational community thing. And this letter, all of a sudden, this letter comes, like, you know, all right. So, in April 10th, 1851, the frustrations he's having over everything, Rav Hirsch wrote to Yehoshaphat, accepting the new position.
Wow.
In May 4th, Rav Hirsch wrote to the authorities that they should find a suitable replacement. Now, could you imagine the storm it created when all the people in Austria said, wait a minute, Rav Hirsch is leaving them. And for what? like a small little society in Frankfurt? But they realized the greatness, the godliness of Rav Hirsch. So what was their reaction? Okay, this is actually the letter that Rav Hirsch wrote to the board. I received an appeal from Frankfurt to go to the aid of this tiny group, whose very founding is, in my view, given the goals of my life, the most promising development that occurred in Jewry within the last 7 decades. For now, for the first time, a Jewish community has been formed, which is openly and proudly dedicated to a most holy principle in an area which has been successfully conquered by the forces of confusion. What could I do? This holy cause is the very one to which I have consecrated my life. And this was the letter that that Rav Hirsch sent to the Minister of Religious Affairs of Moravia. I guess it was the government that was in charge of the Jewish community.
A Jew?
I don't know if it looks like the letter to the minister could have been he was a Jew. I don't know. But this was the government
of Austria.
Of Moravia. Okay. Now, what happens? Moravian Jewish community was in shock. Rav Hirsch would leave 50,000 for 100 families. The rabbis urged, they said they went into like emergency mode. And they got all the 50, they said every city has to send representatives now to convince Rav Hirsch not to go. And that's what they did. They started right now, they gave him everything he wanted. Okay, for the taxes things, we're gonna work on getting you the taxes. Schools, you got it. You want a seminary, you want a school for rabbis to teach them on things, you got that too. Plus, we're pledging the money now to build that school. And Rav Kalish, who was a very wealthy man, said, I'm gonna give you 10,000 gilden dowry for every one of your kids. He had, now, Rav Hirsch had 10 kids, 8 of them were born already. So he had 8 kids already when this offer was made. So now we're ready, wait a minute, now it's a different story. But still in all, he said, look, I already gave them my word I'm coming. So it's up to you now. You have to convince them if they release me of my vow, my word is very important. If they release me, I'll stay. So some say it was like, did he really believe that they had the long-term desire, you know, maybe the short-term shock of it, okay, we'll give it to you, but maybe over the long-term they would stop. Maybe he wasn't 100% convinced on all that. But this is where, so, okay, that's. But basically he said, if they release me of it, I'll stay. That's basically what he said. My word is holy, but I gave them this time, and they will ask you to. So he sent a message to Frankfurt, He said, Frankfurt is sending you a delegation, and they are going to ask you to release me of the vow that I made for you in the name of 50,000 Jews. That's what the letter to Rav Hirsch, he said, just, I'm telling you, this is what's going to happen. Sure enough, the delegation of Moravia made its way to Frankfurt, and the delegation of Moravian Jews said, they refused. They said, this is what they said, if they said Rav Hirsch doesn't come, it would be for them a spiritual suicide. If we can't get a rub, that's it, we're finished, that's it, there's nothing that we can do. And they did not release Rav Hirsch, and Rav Hirsch is now going to move from Moravia, he's going to move to Frankfurt, and for the next about 37 years or so, he's going to be in this community. He is going to make tremendous strides for the community. I don't think the community is ever going to be larger than his community, 5,000 different people, but everything is going to be a battle. He's now going to have to battle the forces of reform. He's going to have to battle the Jews among his community himself. And what he does now becomes like the outline, the way that we today live our lives is going to be very similar. We learn a lot from the way Rav Hirsch took this fledgling nothing community and turned it into a beautiful, beautiful, very, very strong, from Stark Jewish community, with all his philosophies and all his energies and his writings. And I guess really, if we had another week, I would continue Rav Hirsch in Frankfurt and a little bit what his philosophies are vis-a-vis the Jewish community and our purpose in Gullis and all his writings and everything. So I thank you all for coming for this year. This was a great, great year. And Amir Tzashem, next year I hope to continue, most likely continue with Rav Hirsch. But I'm thinking also we would start to, now in the 1800s, we have different areas that we have to deal with. We have Hungary under the Chassam Sofer and the Ksav Sofer. We also have the Yeshiva movement, which we really have not. We did speak about the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, but his top student, Rav Chaim Volozhin, started the Volozhin Yeshiva, which is called the Ema Yeshivas, which all the yeshivas today all can stem. We could all trace our ways all the way back to the Volozhin Yeshiva. Mm-hmm. That movement we also have to speak about. It's going to be now the 1800s. We're now coming to Israel. Eretz Yisrael, the Jewish community there, the fights that they have between the old Yishuv that was there with the Zionists, the new secular Zionists that are coming, and the Mizrahi as opposed to the Haredim, and that's all coming up. This is like you think a three-ring circus, this is like a 10-ring circus. Everything's going on all over the place. Once again, I'd like to thank you all for coming. It's a tremendous chizik for me. And I gain at least as much, if not more, than just being able to present. Thank you so, so much.